very eager about it and started spinning a bit, getting fitter, bought myself a mountain bike. And then my brother-in-law and myself entered my first mountain bike race. And it was, I think, about 20 kilometers, something like that, in Paul. And so we went early in the morning, we went on the mountain bike race. And then, again, similar to a story that Jock shared some time ago, there were sort of two groups. There was a group that did the 55K race, which were the hardcore people, and then us with the school kids in the 20K race. But luckily for us, the 55K people started an hour before us, and they were off and away doing their race. We were cycling with the school kids, and I sort of first through the town, and eventually we went up a bit of a hill, and I take it that's where the mountain bike part of it came in. And then as we seemed to be coming down sort of a slope of a mountainside again, there was a little turn that said 55K. That's the route. And I said, but this what we've been doing here has really been a joke. Don't you think we should do the 55K one? And he said, why not? And so off we went. Now we were an hour behind the rest of the people. And I said, we'll catch up. We'll be fine. And in the beginning, it went well. We were in good spirit. We were chatting on jeep tracks, riding next to each other. And then suddenly the hills started. But it just never ended. Hey? I mean, kilometer after kilometer after kilometer. It was a hill. I mean, it's a hill. It felt like 45 degree angle hills with loose rocks on it. So you're spinning, you're trying to get up, and then it seems like it's coming to an end at the top. And when you get to that top, you didn't think it was possible, because as you look at the horizon, it seems like that's it. But then when you get to the top, there'll be another one, and we'll just change direction. And we'll go up that one, and then there's sort of a dance up, and you think, thank God, this must be it now, you know. Now it's because at some point we need to go down. And you go down for like 30 meters, and there's a turns a corner, it goes back up again. And it went on like that for hours at an end. Eventually, we got to, what is the tall monument in English? Certainly not the language monument, is it? Is it? What a weird name. The tall monument. Okay. Eventually, we got to the tall monument. And there was a little sort of a bathroom with a little basin where we could drink some water. And at that time, my brother-in-law said to me as he walked out of there, he said, listen here. Why don't they just put a gun in here so that you can shoot yourself? Now, this is about five hours in. Now, sometimes we hit a wall where you get to a point, I'm sure for those of us that have run a half marathon or a marathon or done sort of anything extreme that you've not necessarily been that well trained for, even if you train sometimes, you hit a wall. And you get to a point where you feel like, why don't they just leave a gun here so that I can shoot myself? I think sometimes in the Christian life, in the Christian faith or race, sometimes we can get to a similar point. Don't know if you've ever been there. Sometimes you get to a point in your Christian walk where you feel like, this is so challenging, this is ridiculous. Certainly God cannot expect this from me. Certainly this is too challenging. This is too hard. Why don't they just give me a gun so I can shoot myself spiritually and call it quits and call it a day? A wall. What we're going to take a look at today in Hebrews chapter 12 is we're going to take a look at a group of first century Christians who hit a wall in their faith. It's a group of Christians that got to a point where they felt like, why don't we just pull out a gun and shoot ourselves? Why don't we just call it quits? Why don't we just end it right here, right now? The book of Hebrews seemingly is written to a group of Jewish Christians. Now, I know that is not that familiar for us, but obviously they were first just Jews, and then some Jews became Christians, and they were Jewish Christians, and then the other lot was Gentile Christians. These were Jewish Christians that believed in the Messiah to come, and they believed that Jesus was that Messiah that would come. And so they started following him. They made him Lord. They got baptized. They became Jewish Christians. But in the book of Hebrews, as we read it, we see that these guys are several years in the race into being Christians. And several years in, they sort of looked at it and said, well, boy, this is a little bit different than what we expected. Several years in, they looked at it and said, but we are suffering a lot because of our faith. Several years in, they said, listen here, there is still sin that we simply don't seem to be able to overcome. And they started doubting. They started doubting whether Jesus was really the long-awaited Messiah. They thought maybe he was just a man. Maybe he was just a prophet. Maybe he was just an ordinary fellow with some or the other message. They doubted. And so the author of Hebrews addresses this issue. Now, in our time together this morning, we're not going to be able to read the whole book. But in what it is that we're going to be looking at in Hebrews chapter 12, you in many ways need to be able to get the whole book. So I'm going to explain some of it. But then also, I want to ask us that if you can, to go home and actually read it, to be able to get better context of it. Because what happens early on in the book of Hebrews is he starts explaining to them about Jesus, and he says, listen here, Jesus is actually God's son. Jesus is actually greater than the prophets. Now, the Jews held the prophets in great esteem. In other words, they believed the prophets to be God's men, and that they believed that the prophets brought them God's word. But early on in Hebrews, he says to them, listen here, Jesus is even greater than the prophets. Then he goes to the next step and he says, you know what? Jesus is even greater than the angels. Now, for the Jews, they had a higher regard for angels. Obviously, as we study the scriptures, we see a number of encounters that people had with angels. The angel of God would appear. He would bring a message. So there was a higher regard for angels. The author of Hebrews is saying to his audience, he says, listen here, Jesus, you think the angels were something? That's nothing. Jesus even greater than the angels. And obviously, they held an even higher regard as the angels. They held Moses in an even higher regard. And he says to him, listen here, Jesus is even greater than Moses. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the holy priest or the high priest. He is the one that has died for our sins. He is the one that opens the door for us. He is the one that creates and gives us opportunity. Then from there, he switches into Hebrews chapter 11. I think many of us know that. It's known sort of as the Faith Hall of Fame. And he goes sort of throughout different people throughout history in the Jewish faith about how they held onto their faith in spite of hitting a wall. And he speaks about Noah, and he says, listen, Noah persevered in his faith. Abraham persevered in his faith. Moses persevered in his faith. Okay, so by now the crowd is psyched. So when we get to Hebrews chapter 12, what you need to try and picture, how many of us have seen the movie Braveheart? Wow, we're all Braveheart watchers. There is a scene in Braveheart where Mel Gibson, aka William Wallace, where he gives a speech to the troops where they need to fight for freedom. And all the troops are in the background and he's sort of going up and down with his horse. I can't really copy it that well. But he's up and down with his horse. His face is painted in war paint. And he gives them this charge and he says, listen here, the enemy outweighs us. They outnumber us by far. And he says, listen here, what we can do today though, it says we can walk away and we might live longer. But really, in a way, in a sense, we can go lie down in our beds, but we've died in our hearts because we've given up on our freedom. We've given up on our ability to fight for what we believe in. That's the William Wallace speech. Now, what you need to understand is here, as we get to Hebrews chapter 12, that is the tone and the feel of what he is about to say. This is their William Wallace speech. This is not a psalm. This is not a love letter. This is a charge that he is giving them. This is a, listen here, we need to bust through the wall. And we read together in Hebrews chapter 12. Now, see, my PowerPoint has changed. While we read together in Hebrews chapter 12, maybe the guys can find out where my actual PowerPoint is, which is not this one. But we'll read together so long in Hebrews chapter 12. Let's read together from verse 1. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, Remember, we're coming out of Hebrews 11. Who's the cloud of witnesses? Abraham, Moses, Noah, David, Samuel, Jephthah, the prophets. It says, therefore, remember the charge, William Wallace. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Saying, guys, what you got to understand here is you're not alone in this. Have you ever felt alone in the Christian race? Have you ever been in a situation where you're at work and you need to stand up for something that's right? Or even in the morning, you get up, the alarm clock goes off because you're going to have your time with God and you know that everyone else is sleeping in. Have you ever been in a moment like that and you think, well, I'm the only one. No one else is doing this. Just me. Who of us ever felt that way? It's just me. He's saying, listen, you're not alone. You are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses cheering you on. In Rome, there was obviously the Colosseum. And they would have these battles and things in the Colosseum, and in it would be a crowd. That's what would come to mind for the people. There would be a crowd of witnesses cheering them on. Have you ever had someone cheer you on, a crowd of witnesses? Here comes my other PowerPoint in red. Who of you guys are Springbok rugby players? Players. Okay, we're no Springboks. Bafana players? Okay, so we have not had too many people that have crowds cheering them on. Now, I remember back about 14 years ago, 1998, Lisa and I got married, and she entered a bridal competition. Someone said, hey, there's a bridal competition. I think it was called Die Burger or The Burger and Tiger Valley Bridal Competition. And she entered, he just sent in a little photo, and then she won sort of the spot for Bride of the Month. And then there was a competition where they take the 12 months and they have a Bride of the Year competition. And so there we were, the two of us, on the Bride of the Year. I'm just the sidekick. I'm just there to make it look more real, more complete. And so we are there. We're in Tiger Valley in their promotional court. And both Lisa and I, we're not really such public people, meaning we don't necessarily like attention or spotlight or what have you. It makes it hard when you need to speak every Sunday. But, so there we were, and we're thinking to ourselves, man, what are we doing here? Because every time you'll walk up and down, and then there would be four judges, and they would rate you. But what was great was that about half of the church was out there. So every time that Lisa and I stepped onto the stage, just hear the crowd. Now, man, that was really cool because you sort of feel, oh, this is not really for me. I'm not. What are we doing here? And then we walk in, and the crowd's cheering us on. And she ended up winning the competition. And the next day in the paper, one of the articles said was, it was just amazing how much the crowd loved them. Thank you, guys. Thank you for those of you that were there. It was sort of a rent-a-crowd moment, but it was actually, I was thinking, I wonder how that sort of influenced the judge's decision. Every time we walk up, we just walk up. And the crowd is cheering. The disciples were cheering. What these guys are saying, and what the author of Hebrews is saying, is when you're at that wall, and I think some of us are at it today, when you're at that wall and you feel like, I don't know if I can continue, I don't know if I can do this, as these guys, I don't know if he's really the Messiah. You're not alone. He's saying you have a crowd of witnesses. You have the disciples of old, the Noahs, the Abrahams, the Moses, the Davids. And they are cheering you on saying you can do it. You are not alone. But it's so hard. It's been so many years. Moses is saying, I know what it's like. 40 years I was in the desert.
For 40 years, I also said, how long? But I persevered. But it's not working out the way I expected. And Abraham is saying, for 25 years, I waited for the promise to be fulfilled in my son. I know what it's like. You're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. Therefore, he says, since we are surrounded by such a great crowd of witnesses, throw off everything that hinders, everything that weighs you down, that burdens you, and the sin that so easily entangles, and run with perseverance the race marked out for us. He says, since the crowd is there, since you're not alone, since people are cheering you on, throw off everything that hinders. The sin that so easily entangles. That word entangles, the Greek describes it more as sort of that so easily clings. So just throw it off. Have you ever tried to run a race with a lot of baggage? I remember about 20 years ago, more or less even this time of the year, 20 years ago, I was in the Navy. And was doing basic training, and the purpose was to get you as fit as humanly possible. And what we would do is we would do these races as platoons. We would be about a platoon of about 90 people. Navy works very different than the Army, but we were about a platoon of about 90 people. And then we would do a 15 or 20 kilometer race, but for the 90 of us, In the race, because it would be different platoons against each other, each platoon would have to take along with them, I can't remember how much it was, 6 or 10 metal beds, a couple of telephone poles, a couple of these big oil or petrol barrels. They would be empty, about a couple of those barrels, a couple of tractor tires, a couple of sandbags, a couple of car tires, and a couple of other things. And this had to go with you. So we would run, and then you would run four men to a bed. It's two in the front, two in the back. And you would try and get anything that you can on the beach. Again, this is running in sand. You try and get anything that you can on the beach, like a piece of foam light, and put it on your shoulder, because that thing just, it slices you open, or a pole, or those barrels. They're not even that heavy, but you know what it's like to run with a barrel on your shoulders. It is a mission. We would get to the other side half dead. We would, with the sandbags, guys would poke holes in it. eventually we got used to it and we got better at it. But then what would happen is every morning you'll sort of hear what we're doing for that day. And what would happen is they would say, they'll get the platoon together and say, okay, guys, what we're doing this morning is we're doing a 20K race. So 20K race, and the first thing is, and what goes with us? They say nothing. We're like, oh, this is awesome. Great, bring it on. Just 20Ks with nothing. You felt free. Because we've been carrying that burden for so long, suddenly 20Ks felt like nothing. What is burdening you? What is that sin that is clinging on to you? You've hit a wall because you can't carry it any longer. He says, therefore, throw off everything that hinders, the sin that so easily entangles, and then run. Run the race that is marked out for us. Run. Is this you in your Christian race? I'm running it, man. Giving my best to the Lord. From right here, right now. Fully devoted. That's me. He says, run, not sit. Not sit the Christian race, not walk the Christian race, not jog the Christian race. Run, run the race. The word run there in Greek would most probably be better described as rush, progress, effort, consistent. It's moving forward. He says, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and run. Not sprint. Because sometimes we sprint. We get tired. We drop over. No. Run run the race marked out for us. Let's look further in verse 2. Let us, he continues to give us advice, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of God, sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus. Because remember, they were doubting Jesus. Say, listen here, guys, we have a hero in Jesus. We have someone, remember, that is greater than the prophets. In Jesus, we have someone that is greater than the angels. In Jesus, we have someone that is greater than Moses. He is the author and perfecter. Most probably better translated would be pioneer or trailblazer. He's the one that showed us how to start the faith and perfecter, finish the faith. He has showed us how to start the race, run the race, and he has showed us how to finish the race. He is the author and perfecter of our faith. He says, therefore, fix your eyes on him. How did he do it? How did he do it? How was he able to run such a good race? And the Bible gives us the answer. Jesus had the ability, if you look at the scripture, look at what it says here. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus had this ability. Jesus had the ability to zoom out of his life. In other words, to back up and look at the big picture, he could zoom out. And he could say, where is all of this going? And it says what he had before him was the joy set before him. And what was the joy that was set before him? To sit on the right hand of God. So Jesus in the midst of the challenge, Jesus in the midst of his war was able to zoom out and say, where is all of this going? The right hand. The glory of God. That is my joy. That's where I want to be. And then what did he do? He was able to zoom back in. It says, then he endured the cross. Then he scorned its shame. Then he was able to break through that wall because he was able to zoom out. He was able to distance himself from the situation and look at the big picture. Zoom out and then zoom back in. When you're at a war, we have to be able to do the same thing. We have to be able to zoom out. We have to be able to move out and backwards from the place that we are at emotionally, mentally, physically, or spiritually. We need to be able to zoom out, and we need to be able to say, where am I heading? I'm so stuck in the race, but where am I heading? Where am I going? What is the future? What is the future that I'm trying to move into? What is the future? We want to be with Jesus. We want to be with God. That's what it's all about. It's not about the day-to-day. It's about where we want to be in the future. And when we get there, when we say, listen here, what it's about is about God and about being in eternity and his presence. Then zoom back in and endure. He says, fix your eyes on that. Fix your eyes. I think any parent with young children knows how to fix their eyes. It's amazing how you learn this ability. That with my kids, I'm able to be in any environment and still check them out. So no matter where we are, whether we're at church, whether we go for coffee somewhere, and the kids are running around, I'm talking to you, but my eyes are roaming. I'm with you, actually. I am, believe it or not, following the conversation. But my eyes are constantly fixed. Where are my kids? Where are my kids? Are they okay? Are they safe? Are they okay? Are they safe? And as soon as you see someone sort of step over a line that they're not supposed to, you can say, sorry, just excuse me for a moment. Let me just attend to that. Why? Because I've been fixing my eyes on them the whole time. Saying that's what we need to do. We need to fix our eyes on Jesus. We need to constantly be keeping our eye on him. We're doing life. We're going to work. I'm a campus student. I'm at school. I'm doing what I need to be doing. But my eyes is constantly. It's fixed. Zoom out. Zoom in. Zoom out. Zoom in. He continues. Verse 3. Consider him, Jesus, who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. He says again, consider him. Same as before. Fix your eyes on him. Contemplate on his life. Contemplate on the tasks that he had at hand. And that gives perspective. Have you ever felt in your Christian life that what God expects is just too much? Who of us have ever felt that? Let's be honest. I'll put up two hands. I'll put my foot up as well if need be. I remember when I first became a Christian, or was in the process of becoming a Christian, friends helping me, and it came to sort of a wall. And the wall for me was, this is 20 years ago, but the wall for me at that time was smoking. I smoked. The Bible says your body is a temple. Okay, holy, purity, what have you. I couldn't do it. But why, Lord? I smoked Chesterfield. Why take Hester away from me? Now, if I, when people have faded, Chester has always been close to my heart and my top pocket. But some of you can laugh at mine, but maybe someone else laughs at yours. Perspective. What God is asking you to give up, what is that like in comparison to what Jesus had to give up for you? What is it like, the getting up earlier, the staying on the straight and narrow, the making the commitment to actually follow? What is it like in comparison to dying, to being martyred, to being beaten, to be spat upon? He says, consider him, to get perspective. Because when we consider him and we get perspective, he says, do that so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. We need to get perspective. Verse 5. And you have forgotten the word of encouragement. Now listen to that word. It's sort of hard to grasp. The word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone that he accepts as a son. Saying discipline is what? Encouragement. He says, you have forgotten the word of encouragement. Then he says, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart. Discipline, the Greek word there, can be training, discipline, training, education. So do not make light of the Lord's discipline, his training of you, his education of you, and do not lose heart. We tend to do one of two things when we are trained or disciplined by God. One, exactly as he says, we make light of it. I mean, God is working in on you. He's trying to teach you. He's putting obstacle versus obstacle versus obstacle. Challenge versus challenge. But you're not getting it. You're making a light of it. As a matter of fact, you're still praying, show me the way. God's like, man, I'm doing it. Look at the way. Show me the way, Father. Where are you? I'm right here. I'm trying to show you the way. So one is we either make a light of it, or two, we grow weary. The Greek there actually is faint. We faint. In other words, God puts a challenge in your life. It's just too hard. I just give up. So we either ignore or we faint. And we just say, I can't do this. He says, listen, don't go that way. Don't go that way. How should we respond to the training, to the education, to the discipline? How should we respond to suffering and difficulty? We should look at it and see it as a word of encouragement, saying God still loves you. Through this training, through this education, you're saying, you're my son. you're my daughter. I'm still interested in you. That's why I'm trying to train you. I'm trying to educate you. I'm trying to help you.
He continues, verse 7, endure, that's a hard word, endure hardship as discipline, as training, as education. God is treating you as sons or sons and daughters. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirit and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while, as though they thought best. But God disciplines us for our good, that we might share in his holiness. Who of us are parents in here? Okay. Who of us just loves, enjoys, and gets a kick out of it, disciplining our kids? Sort of the fun moment in your day. Now, for some of us, and our kids are grown adults themselves, and they maybe even grandparents, but try and go back in time. Who of us sort of think, man, I can't just wait for that. I just love disciplining them. I just love going in the bathroom with my kids and taking out Woody and talking through it and spanking, and they're crying and they're screaming. I just love doing it. It's one of my favorite parts. No, I don't enjoy it at all. It's a lot easier to not discipline. It is a lot easier to actually, when there's sibling rivalry, lock them up in a room, let them kill themselves. Now lock it and wait for the voices to quiet, and when there's one left, then you're now a one-child parent. Discipline, resolved. No more rivalry. That is a lot easier. So why do I discipline? Why do I put up with it? Why do I push through it? Why do I go to that bathroom every single time? Why do I do it? Because I love them. I want them to live. And I know that if I don't teach them, if I don't train them, if I don't develop their characters, they're going to have a hard life. But if I can teach them, if I can train them, if I can help them to build their characters, they will live. What the author is saying is if me, a sinful dad, knows that and does that in love for my kids, how much more should discipline not be a sign of God's love for us as adults? He says, therefore, submit and live. In the early days of my two oldest kids, disciplining didn't go down easily, especially with both of them. But one in particular, what would happen is our deal works is that they commit an offense. In other words, they are either disrespectful or disobedient, or they lie. Those are sort of our three biggies. Then it's go to the bathroom. I go to the bathroom, and then in the bathroom, I'll sit and I'll explain. Okay, what crime have you committed? Okay, I want them to know this is why you're going to get disciplined. And they say, okay, well, I did this, or I did that, or what have you. Then when it came to spanking time, the one was like trying to spank an octopus, really. It is impossible. I mean, she's holding onto your leg, she's in the bath, and then I'm pulling out of the bath. Now, obviously, you get elastic yourself, and you get clever. I would sort of pin down the one leg like this, and then I'll grab Woody like this, and then I'll look for a clear shot. But I mean, it's that bum is moving like this. So it's you got to literally sort of lock on target. It's lock on target, then you go quickly and you go, boom! Now, I had to even discipline that. I had to help them. Listen, if you put your hand on your bum when I want to spank it, your hand is going to go up in flames because I'm going to spank that hand. And that's not going to be the spanking. That's just for the hand. Then the real McCoy must still come.
are you like an octopus with God? Where God is trying to teach you something, he's trying to train you, he's trying to educate you, but you are all over the show. And God's trying to pin you down, and you're crying out, why, Lord, why? And he's saying, because you're not submitting. You're not submitting. You're all over the place. You're in the bath. You're out of the bath. And I'm looking for a clean shot. And you put your hand on there, and that thing that you're going through, that's just the woody for the hand. The other stuff is still coming. Don't be like an octopus. Don't try and dodge and dive. Don't try to ignore. Don't try to run away. Submit. Submit. Allow the discipline to run its course, to do its work. Why? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us. Why? For our own good. Why? That we may share in his holiness. Zoom out. Why am I going through this? Why is God either willing or allowing this challenge in my life? Zoom out. Why? For your own good. For your own good. So that you may share in his holiness. Zoom out. Holiness. That's where I'm going. That's where I'm heading. Zoom in. Endure. Push through. Verse 11. Whoops. Pressed something wrong there. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Now, with my kids, when they were younger, when they were, one is 9, the other one's 5, and then the other one is still very small. But the 9-year-old and the 5-year-old, when they were in their three-year age, and it was the bathroom, spank this, spank that, I felt like I was going to go nuts. I felt like, is this ever going to work? Is this ever going to pay off? But many that have gone ahead said, push through, push through. You know what? Today, my two older kids, they're still naughty, and like all of us, they have their issues, but it's amazing to have seen how they've grown. It is amazing to see for me how my kids are overcoming their weaknesses in character. It's amazing to see how they're becoming more loving and more interested in people. And yes, like all of us, they've got a far way to go, and I've got a far way to go. But I've seen them grow. I've seen the harvest being produced. Why? And here's the key for us. Because they have allowed themselves to be trained by it. Listen to the words. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, though, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace. Doesn't stop there. For who? For those who have been trained by it. Discipline does not equal harvest of peace and righteousness. Difficult times does not equal harvest of peace and righteousness. God says, I'm going to go through a difficult time, but at some point there will be a harvest of peace and righteousness, because how much misery can one person endure? No. For those who have been trained by it, for those who have allowed the education to run its course, for those that have taken the lessons from it, there will be a harvest of peace and righteousness. So while I'm at the wall, while I'm in the middle of my challenge, what should I do? Zoom out. Where am I going? I want to be with Jesus. I want to be able to experience his holiness. I want to become like him. I want to be different. So let me zoom back in. Let me submit to the training. Let me follow his path. Let me allow it to run its course. Let me be trained. And what's going to happen? A harvest of peace and righteousness will come. Therefore, he closes out in verse 12 and says, therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and your weak knees. Therefore, because we have hope, because we have Jesus that is greater than the prophets, because we have Jesus that is greater than the angels, because we have Jesus that is greater than Moses, let us fix our eyes on him. Let us zoom out and know we're heading to eternity and to holiness. Let us zoom in, break through the wall, and experience God's grace and God's peace. Amen. Let's close with a word of prayer.